Good morning. Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with...
You guys wake up early.
Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the NUMAD Group, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch, two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us a mother, a mentor, and a journalist. The NUMAD Group would like to extend a special thanks to Wes Brown and South Dakota Public Broadcasting for sound and recording, Scott with Sumner Law for brewing coffee, Barefoot Dance Studios for some of the chairs you're sitting in, Kelly and Sunny for setup, the members of the Garage co-working space for letting us use your space, and for everyone here for joining us at 7 a.m. For further information about what goes on in the Garage, please follow us on Facebook and check out garagerapidcity.com, live tweet at hashtag MorningPhilip. And now with all of that, please join me in welcoming Rainey Aronson, the executive producer of Frontline. Thank you for coming to South Dakota.
Of course. This is
your first time in South Dakota.
I know, I hate to say it, but it's true. I've never been here before. I'm pleased to be here. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you've already seen Mount Rushmore today.
I know, we woke up early. You guys think you woke up early. No, I promised my children that if I was going to come to South Dakota, that we were all going to come back. And unfortunately, snow days meant that they couldn't come with me today. But we were all going to come here together, and we'll come back, and it's beautiful. So I promised them that I would go and see the beauty, and it was amazing.
Well, thank you for making the time to be here. And I know it's not easy. A couple flights and drives, and we really appreciate your time being here. To start us off, would you take us back to when you first knew that you wanted to be a journalist or in media? Could you talk a little bit about that with us?
Yeah, sure. There's a couple of points. I guess any of us who have had long careers can look back and tell the story a different way depending on the day. But I think the most important part of my life when it came to journalism was growing up in a rural town in Vermont, a very small town, less than 1,000 people, and my parents chose not to have a television, and they also chose to live off the grid. So I grew up in a quite unusual way. And what we did have was public radio. And so in my home was VPR, which is Vermont Public Radio. And as a kid who was really hungry for the outside world, just naturally as a person, I was curious about the outside world. That sort of inspired me from the very beginning to think about what is it that we do as journalists to help people across the country, but also the world, understand the rest of the world. And I didn't know it then, but that was really the roots of how I was inspired to start to tell stories, you know, and that's what I do for a living.
So you grew up in rural Vermont, off the grid. Could you talk a little bit about what that experience was like? Because I think you shared that you were 8 when you moved there.
Right.
And your parents built the house that...
Right.
You grew up in?
So it's the 1970s, so it was an era in which a lot of people on the East Coast, but here too, I'm sure, were making decisions about making alternative lifestyle moves, and my parents decided to move to Vermont and be environmentalists, so they chose this life, and they did build a house. It was an octagon house. They still live there. They're pretty committed to this lifestyle. But I was 8, and so I knew about another lifestyle, which is a house and running hot water and a television. My younger siblings didn't, so we have different perspectives on what it was like to grow up in that way, which is so interesting, right? What you're born into versus what you then acquire as a child. And I went to the local public schools. That was probably what taught me the most about America, but also just about journalism, is that I didn't go through the private school setting, which a lot of journalists on the East Coast have. And so I lived inside a community, played sports, did everything, was a debater. And I think the thing that it taught me the most was that, you know, you can live with a lot less than you think that you can. In other words, There was no running hot water, so we had to actually heat our water. And these were choices my parents made. So it's not as if we had to live that way. That's another whole dynamic, right? But I do think it taught me that I could live anywhere in the world with a lot less. And so I did live in places like India, places across the world, which actually, not by choice, have a lot less. And I was an American who could survive and thrive in any setting because of that upbringing.
And you went from Vermont to Wisconsin, right, for
right.
college.
Right. So I basically made a decision in high school. A lot of the high school kids that I went to high school with did not go to college. It's a pretty working class, farm-based community, and a lot of the people stayed and worked on the farm, or they just stayed and worked in little shops. I mean, it's a teeny little town. I chose to go to college, and I went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I basically chose the biggest school I could get into. So again, that's like a running theme. I mean, I always say to my parents, like, you took me to nowhere land, right? And I chose to go to the biggest cities and biggest schools I could go to. So my inclination was to be around a lot of people. And so I landed in Madison, Wisconsin, and that was really the start of journalism in the sense of I worked for the college paper, which is a very good paper. And I learned about journalism there, but I was actually a history major and a South Asian studies major, so.
And why Southeast Asia? Why history and why Southeast Asia?
Well, you know, you can't really answer these questions, like looking back at 18, you know, the decisions we all made, right? But what I do think is I was, again, really curious about the world, and what I chose to do was I had this idea that I wanted to live overseas, and so I chose India as the place to live. And then I backed into my studies. Again, this is not logical, but it worked out really well. And so when I, you know, I have a kid now who's 13 and he starts to talk about his future and I'm thinking like, how does this all work out? You know, I'm just so glad that my parents didn't stop me and say like, don't do that. That sounds very unrealistic. But at the time, I chose that I wanted to live in Asia. I thought that I was going to be a diplomat. I didn't think about journalism. I thought I would be one of the people who would work as an ambassador somewhere for America in the world. That was my overarching idea. But then once I got to India, as a 19 and 20 year old, and then after that I lived in Asia for 3 years in Taiwan, I was based out of Taiwan, I started to realize that journalism was gonna be the home for my career because I didn't wanna represent the government. I actually wanted to hold governments and people accountable. And I wanted to ask tough questions. So I wanted to be independent in my questioning. And so that led me to journalism.
Can we talk a little bit about journalism?
Sure.
And would you describe the work of a journalist, of a reporter?
So there are a ton of different types of journalists. The work that we do is accountability journalism in the current affairs space. So Frontline, generally speaking, tells a story that is going on right now. And then what we're trying to do is ask questions about how did we get here and where are we going? So we usually have a narrative structure. Usually there's a once upon a time in a Frontline, but we take you on a journey of discovery through the work itself. The work I was most attracted to as a younger person was, again, this area of accountability journalism, meaning that I realized very early on, I was a reporter in Taiwan, in Taipei, Taiwan. That's where I started my career, officially started in Taipei, that a lot of the things that were happening at the local level actually needed to be written about, but not just sort of reported on as if you were there as an observer, but actually questions needed to be asked. To give you some context, when I was there, it was the first democratic election ever for the country. And so a lot of political groups that were forming were doing things without a lot of rules and regulations. And I right away noticed that, oh, well, maybe I should start writing about that. And again, I'm a young person, so I wasn't thinking about it critically that I was going to end up running Frontline. But I think the roots of my curiosity is about how do groups form and do they do it to the rule book or do they sort of go around and break rules was at the essence of what I was doing in Taiwan years ago.
Interesting, too, you started in the print
yes.
side of things. Can you talk a
yeah,
little bit about
I mean,
that and the difference between...
Television is its own beast. Mm. At the time, it was the early 90s, and newspapers were essentially a way as a young journalist that you could convince your parents that you would have a job. So, I mean, really, right? Part of our lives, you know, when you're a child, is telling your parents, okay, I'm going to go into journalism. I'm not going to be a doctor. not going to be a teacher. I'm going to be a journalist, but say I'm going to work in an industry that has the potential for jobs. And when I've talked to my father, who I would speak to often about this choice, he would say to me, that industry seems like one that will support your career going forward. So in Taiwan, they had a local paper. It was an English paper, but I spoke Chinese, which was useful, as a skill, right? Because if you're living in a foreign country and you can speak their language and you can write in English, you usually get a job. So I started in newspapers and actually went to the Columbia Journalism School as a print student. And I was really a serious writer. But then something happened to me when I was a student there, which is I had to work the overnight shift because I actually had to pay for graduate school. And New York City, any of you who have lived there, is so expensive that we essentially, about half the class had to have extra jobs. But I had to have a real job to pay for my expenses. And I ended up being a translator on a documentary series. And again, this is just by happenstance that I got this job. And it was the overnight shift. It started at about 10 p.m., and I would work through the morning and go to school during the day. And I would find myself at 6 a.m. when I was supposed to leave, not wanting to leave. And so I'm in an edit room looking at this documentary film, and the boss comes in multiple times in a row, asking me why I'm still hanging around. I'm like, well, I just don't want to be anywhere else. And he's like, well, I mean, you have to be a student, right? And you're really not supposed to be here. And I said, well, is there any way I could just come on the weekends? And so they thought I was a bit nuts. So I realized through this experience that the visual form, the form of pictures and story, was actually where I was going to go. And it was just inadvertent that I ended up in that field, being exposed to it, because I had to have a job.
Mm-hmm. And can we talk a little bit about what distinguishes investigative journalism from other types of journalism?
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, anything. I'll talk about anything, Matt.
But you started talking about the democracy and what makes it investigative, I guess, and then how does that translate into frontline today?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a ton of different traditions of journalism, right? So in the stripe of journalism that we're in is sort of asking critical questions. I think one of the easiest ways to think about it is that, the importance of journalism is this. There are communities that are well-meaning communities. There are leaders in those communities. There are governments. And corruption itself doesn't just show its face, right? The reason that journalism is so essential to our democracy is it's one of the checks and balances to truth. So if you have journalists asking tough questions at the state and local level and the national level and actually holding companies and people in power accountable to their word, so if they say something and then we keep reporting on it, we hold people accountable to what they promise. That's what we call accountability journalism or investigative journalism. The other thing is that obviously the work Frontline's done on the NFL, a lot of the work that we've done overseas is asking tough questions about just where is our society right now and where should we be going? So the deeper questions emerge inside investigative journalism. Sometimes can start very small, but then it becomes very profound to the worlds that we're all living in.
And how do you determine what is newsworthy?
Mm-hmm.
How do you come up with, we want to investigate that. We want to look deeper into that and keep digging to report on something. What does it mean to be newsworthy?
So newsworthy, I would say, for Frontline is when you're watching us, you think you know what you're about to see, but then you see something that's quite different. A great example is the film we just did on the Supreme Court. I think a lot of us think that we understand the Supreme Court, but we decided to tell you this story going back about 35 years, right, to really try to understand what's happened to the Supreme Court and why and who have been the players in the middle of it. That's newsworthy because, of course, we're all looking at the court right now and asking critical and also positive questions about what's happening inside the court. And I think that's one of the most important questions we can ask as a democracy is what's happening to our federal government, to what is happening to us in a way that's productive. So Frontline tends to tell you the whole story as opposed to looking just at what's happening today. I think that's really crucial. So I wouldn't call it historical. I would say it's current affairs work with context. So we went back to the Bork moment. We went back to McConnell's earlier, manifestations and what he believed in, and a group of men and women who said that they wanted something inside the Supreme Court that went one way and another way, so that you can understand how we got to where we are right now.
Do you believe that what newsworthy means today is different than what newsworthy meant 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago?
Well, that's like a PhD thesis. I would say you could do your PhD on that. I'll give you the short answer.
Okay.
It's an important question. I think a lot of the media has changed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think where public media comes in and thoughtful media comes in, what we consider newsworthy today is very similar to what we did 5 years ago. We don't change with sort of how commercial media has shifted so thoroughly into sound bites and arguments as opposed to analysis and journalism. So we don't actually think the way that most of the mainstream media has gone is the way that Frontline should go. I also think that there's increasing partisan media. I don't support partisan media for Frontline because I believe that there should be some spaces in journalism that still attempt assiduous, fair dialogue between sides that may not agree, but sometimes do agree, and to show both sides of a story. So Frontline's committed to this day, as much as we have been since the very beginning, from 1983, that there should be a public square of dialogue as opposed to argument and fighting and the bitter vitriol that you see on cable. So this is something that we believe we should protect. We should protect a few spaces to have an honest and open dialogue about issues that really matter.
You talk about fair. Would you say more about what does it mean to, with Frontline, mm-hmm. Under your leadership, what does fair mean? How would you define that?
Well, I mean, we're professional journalists, right? And so in my book, what that means is that we make sure that our reporters and the people producing are not coming in at a story with inherent bias. I do believe that there's unconscious bias in every one of us, and I think that's real. But I think at least in our editorial process, we attempt to ask tough questions of each other so that we get at the most fair way through a story. A great example is when you look at any issue, right, and you turn it around three or four different ways, and we have a very robust editorial team that does this, are you asking yourselves all the right questions? So if you're looking at a corporation, even a corporation that you may believe has done egregious acts, have you given that corporation the benefit of the doubt to give them a point of view, to argue at the issue that you're reporting on as forcefully as possible to try to explain what happened? And do you allow them a voice? So at Frontline, we absolutely do. And as you can see when you watch our programming, people from across the aisle always talk to Frontline for that reason. They're treated with respect, and they're treated seriously, and we never present something that isn't factual. So that's the other really big thing that's the essence of Frontline is investigative journalism has to be based, in my opinion, on facts. So you can't just go out with an opinion about something being terrible or bad. You have to actually be able to prove it. And once you can prove something, you have to have data to back it up. You can't just come out and say such and such happened. You have to be able to then substantiate it. So the bedrock of Frontline is factual journalism as opposed to opinion journalism.
That reminds me of something we read in preparation for this morning, that one of your guiding principles throughout your career has been the idea of reporting against your own assumptions. Can you talk a little bit about why that's important? I think it falls right in line with what you're talking about, but working against or reporting against your assumptions seems to be really important to
right.
you.
Right. So investigative journalists, as a general rule, they really want a story, right? So you want a story. And so I think the inclination is to go for, like, the most incendiary part of the story that you can go for to get the biggest impact, right? That's a human instinct. What I always say at Frontline, and I'm very serious about this, this has to do with anything that we do, is that never assume anything. And be ready for us to ask the very toughest questions of your assumption as a reporter. So if somebody's bringing a story to me, every single word is vetted, and that means we check every single thing that they say against what they're telling us. So we counter-report ourselves constantly. And what that has led to, and I was a producer for Frontline for 12 years before I went into management. So I was actually a reporter being in the same situation that my reporters are in now. You have to want that. You have to want to be challenged at Frontline. And some people love it and some people don't. And if you don't love that and want that kind of challenge, then you don't belong at Frontline. But essentially, it's a Socratic discourse. It's you say something and I argue against you. And somehow in that conversation, we come up with what we believe is fair.
And in that process, how often are stories get killed? Stories get...
Absolutely. Yeah, journalists don't talk about that often, but one of the most important acts in my job is to say that it's not good enough and not to air it. Actually, I mean, it's you don't talk about it because it doesn't air, right? So it's not like that becomes a national dialogue. But I do believe that right now the media landscape is so competitive and people are publishing so quickly that we have really, really said that Frontline's not going to do that. And if something isn't good enough, we hold it back. We make a different decision. And we let it actually, in many cases, we give it more time. So I talk about time a lot because I do believe that the landscape of media has moved so quickly into publishing iteratively every single minute. You know, you'll see something on CNN or these other places that they have to publish so quickly that they're not thinking. So I have a kind of statement at Frontline is that we don't skip at Frontline, we walk at Frontline. Now, the reason I say that is because I don't want us to skip any steps before we publish. And I think that kind of ethos has served us well. We're 37 years old, right? So Frontline's not a young series, but we're also a series that has high stakes. You know, we don't want to get something wrong either. So that takes time and a methodical editorial process that's very serious. And when I'm not doing something amazing like this, you know, really what I'm doing is sitting in edit rooms asking tough questions. That's all I do. That's what I do for a living. So I'm in your shoes, but I'm asking tougher questions. I mean, I might look nice, but, you know, I'm pretty tough.
What questions should I ask you?
No, I'm kidding. No, oh my goodness.
So you started with, when you were growing up, you lived off the grid in Vermont in a rural town. Or outside of a rural town, you ended up as a cheesehead in Wisconsin because that was the furthest, largest school that came in your view. And then you end up in India and then in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And for a few years in Taiwan. And then you came to Colombia.
Right.
And you worked on documentaries and then started working for free on the weekends.
Right.
and then what? What's that journey to this role at Frontline, the executive producer, and when did you know this is what you wanted to do?
The Frontline piece is just, it's a great story, but it's kind of long, so I'm going to have to figure out how to tell it a little more short. Once you have a career for 25 years, it's a little hard to do in 2 minutes, but I'm going to try. I do think the overnight work I did as a student at Columbia was where the sort of light bulb went off that I needed to work on documentaries as opposed to print. I did have to say, and a lot of you have probably been in this situation, that I was going to let down a lot of people at Columbia who really believed in me as a writer. That was one of the hardest decisions I made, was to go into Columbia and say, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm going to work in television. And you know, my professor at the time is a very well-known writer, Seymour Topping, New York Times foreign correspondent, had big dreams for me. And I had to tell him this, and it was like I had devastated him. But I felt so forcefully that the right thing for me to do is to tell stories with pictures. And when I look back at my writing was all anecdotal and all visual. So when I wrote about stories in Taiwan, you know, there was a way that I told a story that was all about what I was seeing. And so those of us who work in storytelling usually find the right way to tell a story at a certain point in your career. You have to follow your own gifts. And my gifts happen to be in the visual landscape. I worked on that documentary series. The second half of that story is my boss at the time kept asking me why I was there in the morning. He then had to share with me something pretty difficult right after Columbia was over, which is that he didn't think I was a great translator. And, you know, I really thought he was going to fire me. I had never been fired, you know, so I was waiting for him to fire me, and I was so apologetic. And he said, yeah, but, you know, you'd make a pretty great PA, which is a production assistant. Would you like to join the film team? And I literally thought I had died and gone to heaven. And the whole office was like, oh, my God, this poor girl. She really needs to, like, calm down. But it was clear that I just was so excited to be on the film team. So that's where I started. That documentary series was actually supported by the Wall Street Journal. So it's interesting how things work out. The Wall Street Journal was, at that time, saying that they really wanted to start to look at the visual landscape. They didn't end up committing to that in the long run, but what it did do is give me access to the Wall Street Journal's editors, and I'd never been edited at that level. And as a young person in my sort of mid-20s, I think why that was so important was because I started to understand that I wanted to professionalize my journalistic chops. In other words, I didn't want to bounce from documentary to documentary. I wanted to actually understand what would it be like to be inside a news organization where I had true leadership that would help me understand how to become a better journalist. So I left that job after it was finished, and I moved into a position at ABC News. And ABC News at the time was doing these very, very serious documentaries with Peter Jennings, who many of you may remember. These hour-long documentaries were really remarkable, and as a young person, really exciting. So that was kind of exactly what I wanted. I wanted to marry journalistic current affairs with documentary long-form journalism. And I did that for 6 or 7 years. Some of my best memories in my 20s, in fact, were those years working for Peter and for ABC News and through 9/11 and these really big stories, traveling the world on these big stories. And then something started to happen inside commercial media, which we've now seen the consequence of, which is that increasingly the journalism at ABC News was being essentially diminished intellectually because they had to fight for their ratings. And this is understandable. They're a commercial network and they have to survive. So a lot of the very serious work that Peter was doing and many of us were doing or aspired to do, because remember, I was in a much lower level position, a lot of the work I would bring back would be increasingly simplified. And so I had a choice to make when I was about 30, about whether I was going to continue in journalism or was I going to do something else with my life that was more meaningful in an intellectual sense. Was I going to go and get a PhD and become a professor? Was I going to do something where I felt I could have an impact intellectually as opposed to like chasing the ratings? And that's how Frontline came into my life, and that's like a whole other story. But the story of Frontline is that I started to see that was a medium in which you could have your cake and eat it too. You could have a story that you couldn't take your eyes off of that was also meaningful in journalistic terms. And working for Frontline wasn't like, oh, you just pick up the phone and call Frontline. You don't do that, right? Especially when you're young. But there were some serendipitous moments that connected me with the founder of Frontline during the early part of my career that really led to me joining Frontline as a young producer when I was about 30 or 31.
And when reading a little bit about Frontline and your time at Frontline and a Vanity Fair article a few years ago, the author referenced that you had, quote, a public mentoring period at Frontline with the founder. Would you talk a little bit about that experience and how important that was as an individual and in your career?
Sure.
And
that's
about
like your favorite story. Well, you know, the beginning of my career at Frontline was one of making films. So I really do think my success in part is because I actually made multiple front lines. The front lines that I made, interestingly, were all about the culture wars. So I was really interested in all sorts of issues that intersected between differing points of view. And I did many, many films that really got at that. And we could share some if you're curious. It'd be a little bit interesting to see films that were done 15 or 20 years ago by me about some of the issues that we still deal with today, like abortion rights, like about the evangelical vote in the Bush elections, about issues that surround us when we're talking about the news industry, like News War. We did a big film about how conservative media and progressive media were really eating each other alive and basically destroying what I call, you know, fair, and I wouldn't call it balanced, but fair journalism in the heart of it. And so those are the types of films I told. And so as a journalist, a young journalist, I went through the frontline process multiple times with David Fanning, our founder, and also Lewis Wiley, who is our executive editor at the time. So two people at the helm of Frontline who really took me on as a young producer. And at the time, by the way, I was really one of the only young people producing for Frontline. So it's a very veteran, seasoned group of producers. So I was probably a lot of work. And so that's fine, you know, that's good. I was a work in progress, I still am, and so are all of us, right, if we're honest about it. I think the point with the public mentorship is that at a certain point, David decided that he wanted to bring me into the management of Frontline. I wasn't so convinced, by the way, at first. I really didn't think that I was going to be a great management fit. I thought I should just make films for the rest of my life. He convinced me otherwise. So sometimes mentors intersect with your life and convince you of something that's good for you without you knowing it. And in fact, he was right. So that was now 8 years ago, almost 10 years ago. Forgive me, it's been 10 years where I came into a position that's called a senior producer at Frontline. What that means is something really important. It means that you can fix a film. That means you can go into an edit room, much like a print editor can, and you can take somebody's documentary and make it better. I had no idea what I was doing in the beginning. So the very first thing that David did is he gave me access to his process fixing a documentary. This is a little in the weeds, but why it's so important is that it was in those early years where I didn't have the pressure of doing it myself that I was able to learn how to do it. So you have to be a certain kind of person to want to be taught something, and then you have to be a certain type of person to want to teach. And in that relationship, it was all about that. So, and I'm a very good student, it turns out, to things I want to learn about, not about things I don't want to learn about. So my parents were always like, you're a little inconsistent. That's true. What I wanted to learn about was how to make a film better. And so he taught me for 4 or 5 years, and then he dropped the big epiphany on me, which is that he wanted to step back from the series in a number of years. And I wasn't quite aware of that at the time, but I was getting the hint. You know, he was making these comments like, yeah, I think in a few years I'll be doing something different. And those comments would just roll off, and I would think, right, so what does that mean? Does that mean that somebody else takes over Frontline, or does it mean that he has this sort of plan here? And he did have a plan. And about 5 years before I took over Frontline, he officially told me that he wanted me to do that and did a crucial thing, which is allowed me about 4 full years of creating the senior team that I wanted, the people around me that I wanted inside Frontline. And essentially, he worked with me to figure out how we were going to sustain and contemporize Frontline. So we did that work together. And that's really important to the success of Frontline, is that it wasn't as if I came in and changed everything after David Fanning left. It's that a lot of the changes that we made were seemingly organic because we did them together. And frankly, he blocked and tackled the rest of the world from those changes. So there was no criticism of those changes because we were able to do it together. And for a series like Frontline that is mature and is really along in its years, it was important for us to change certain elements of it while still maintaining what really matters at the heart of it, the DNA of Frontline, which is journalism, right? And making sure that we continue to do that tradition as well.
And you've added significantly to Frontline and the vehicles in which journalists stories are being disseminated which we'll talk about in a little bit. But before we move to that, other mentors in your life, have there been others that you think about that have had an impact on who you are and who you want to become?
Right, so I'm a person who always sought out mentors without knowing it. So I think that some people do and some people don't. Some people love to be taught. I always say about mentoring, because I have a couple of people I mentor now. I don't realize that I'm doing it, but they tell me I'm doing it. I think the point is that you have to be a person of high enough quality to have a high quality mentor want to mentor you. It's a two-way street, right? And so I would say my first mentor was in high school. I had a fierce debate coach. She was a horse farmer, but she was also one of the most important people in my life, which is Marilyn Childs. And I was really young at the time, obviously in my teens. And she just decided that she was going to make me into a better debater. And we're small, teeny, rural high school, very, very working class. Like, there was no money in the school to pay for anything. So basically, we were a bootstrap debate team. And she decided when I was 15 that we should go to nationals, actually. And so she registered us, which is very crazy looking back. In fact, that was probably the biggest turning point for me, was that then on the national stage we were debating against kids who were across America. And I was exposed to people from all across America in a competitive landscape. And she was very hard on me. That's the other thing. You know, I was thinking about this just in my newsroom, that I have gravitated towards people who told me I needed to do better, not that I did great. So, and that's something that even to this day, that I have David Fanning, obviously, the founder of Frontline, but then we also have other stakeholders in my life who watch Frontline, who I literally wait until the next day to see what they have to say about Frontline. I don't want to have, like, a kumbaya moment. I want to know, what did we get right and what did we get wrong? What could we have done better? And so that's my personality. So in high school, she was always like, well, that was okay, but you could have done better. And that's what drove me, right? Mm-hmm. So this is just a personal thing. Mm-hmm. Some people like to be told that they did a great job. I like to be told, well, that was good, but here are the three things that actually you should have done a better job at, and we have a higher expectation for you. And David Fanning was like that. And by the way, his boss, who is Peter McGee, who found David Fanning, so the original founder, he's always writing me these notes. He's in his late 80s, maybe mid-80s. He's like, well, you could have done this instead of that. Or, you know, he's complaining. And I'm like, well, I'm waiting for Peter's notes. He watches everything. And sometimes when he really likes a frontline, it's like the most satisfying feeling. You know, it's the one person I know is going to tell me exactly the truth. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the report card, mm-hmm. you know. And sometimes he'll love a frontline. And that's great. And then we know he succeeded.
What is it that... when you seek out, intentionally or not intentionally, it sounds like mentors, it's that you're looking for the truth. You want their honest mm-hmm. feedback, and it sounds like you take that and you turn that into...
Well, I definitely think they're, because I have children and everybody gets trophies now. It's not that I don't think it's great to get a trophy. I mean, I'm really happy when my kid, who really can't play sports well, my daughter just got a trophy. It's her first year playing lacrosse, and I'm really happy that she got a trophy. You know, that's a nice day in our home. Mm-hmm. I do think that the culture of giving trophies all the time is a little bit of a problem, because I then see it in the newsroom. So in the newsroom, it's really quite an environment. And we have to be able to be honest with each other about the level of sophistication in our work so it does get better. So I do believe in that. I believe in always questioning, like, could you do better, you know? And I think that's a frontline tradition, but I think it would be good for all of us.
So along the lines of trophies...
And by the way, my daughter is just really excited when she got a trophy, so I was so happy for her, too, you know? As a parent, that's a great moment, and she deserved it for playing hard. But there is, like, a point at which you have to think about, how do we continue the tradition of constructive criticism so that we're better at what we do as opposed to stagnating?
Well, Frontline and you have received a number of trophies yourself.
Mm-hmm. Emmys. That's great, by the way. I love a trophy.
So how
I do actually really love it.
Will you talk about that a little bit? I mean, you have won significant awards, recognition for the work that you've led and done. And that has huge impact in with your staff and on the front line. Will you talk about how that is when you get recognized that way?
I mean, awards are great for a big news organization because, you know, it's a morale booster first and foremost for the staff. They feel that their work is getting noticed. I think some awards are more meaningful than others to me personally. I think the Columbia DuPont Award is one that I know how it's judged and I know how it's measured. So I really do love glamour and big awards. I love them. But I also love it when a group of journalists who are, you know, again, pretty critical and pretty, you know, thoughtful judge our work. So this year we did win the Gold Baton, which hasn't been given to a news organization for 10 years. That was a big moment for me professionally, to have Columbia give that to us. And what they gave the award to us for was even more meaningful, which is that they gave us an award for the body of our work for that year that was documentaries, yes, but also the new forms of storytelling. So why that's significant is because we have started to tell stories in new formats. And I have a staff of people who are dedicated to that. And for them to be included in a big award alongside the broadcast was so meaningful. And when I did stand up at Columbia and speak, I had people who had started Frontline and have been producing for Frontline since the very first year on stage with me. And then I had a whole new generation of storytellers on stage with me. And I decided to invite everybody up. You can share the picture because it's quite a profound picture of cross-generational producing across forms. And I was proud of that. But usually I'm not too proud because I'm on to the next thing. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, we really need to like make sure we keep the bar high for the next film that goes on the air. So we can't rest on any laurels in that regard. But that had meaning to me.
Can we talk a little bit about those new formats and the growth of digital? From what I understand and preparing for today, is that during your time frontline, you noticed some things changing, and you noticed that, and you knew that you didn't have all the information you wanted, and you ended up going back to school at MIT.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. You're going there. Okay.
And
cool.
And one of the things you've talked about, and you've already mentioned it a couple times today, is curiosity being an important piece of that experience. But it was through that willingness to go back and learn and be around people that are in different sectors, different professions, that then you brought back to Frontline. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of business people in this room here. I'm assuming a lot of you are involved with business or your own companies. I think one of the biggest decisions I had, again, in the sort of public mentoring role that I was in, was how do we change Frontline without sort of taking away what's really important about Frontline and making sure that we're telling stories in the digital landscape that are authentic. So I think of the time, which is now 6 or 7 years ago, the inclination was to go out of house to disrupt yourself, right? As opposed to thinking hard about, is there a way internally with frontliners, right? As opposed to like hiring a company to come in and do everything for us. Was there a way for us to organically change and contemporize? Could we do that? And I realized the only way to do that is if I knew what I was actually talking about and sort of just talking. So I didn't know anything other than documentary filmmaking. And so at MIT, they have a really incredible lab that's called the Open Doc Lab. And it's essentially a new storytelling laboratory where they bring storytellers that range from gamers to documentarians to computer scientists. I mean, it was an incredible group of people. And I decided that if I was going to authentically lead this type of transition that actually meant, you know, documentaries that you guys see on television, but also the new stories that we're telling, I had to go back to school. And again, that meant that one day a week I left the office. It doesn't mean that my work lessened. It meant that I just added something to my life. But it was a really important thing to do. It's also incredibly humbling. Any of you, and you guys have a great university and engineering school here, Anytime you enter into those environments and you're not that, it's humbling, right? So I'm a journalist. I know nothing about computer science. And in those rooms, I was like a nobody. So helpful. And I'll explain what I mean. So around the table are, you know, MIT PhDs and computer scientists and gamers who are really brilliant. And then it would come to me and they would say to me, you know, well, who are you? What do you do? And I was really quiet in these meetings at first because I had no idea what was going to happen in those meetings. And then they would say, like, so what do you do? So I said, oh, you know, I'm the number two person in charge of frontline. And they're like, oh, frontline, okay. And they're like, that's television, right? I'm like, yes. Like, so television still exists. Okay, that's good. And literally would look at me like, are you serious? Are you staying in the industry called television? And so it became really clear that they had an opinion. And what happened that year, which is also really great, is that I realized in that conversation that we have a lot to offer as storytellers and thinkers and journalists to computer scientists and gamers. So that sounds very optimistic, but in fact what happened was that, which is that we actually met in the middle, and their skill sets ended up serving my desire to tell stories in a new way. It wasn't as if all of the work that we do was diminished. It's just that they helped me tell the stories better. In fact, I realized that they were quite intimidated by me too, because they don't know how to tell a story. So it was really something that was great. And those people remain some of my closest colleagues. We hire them all the time to help us when we're trying to do experimental stories. Like, we just told a story called The Last Generation that was about the Marshall Islands and climate change, and we decided to tell it in an interactive way online as opposed to a documentary. So if you go into that experience, you can experience data. There's video, but there's also a way to experience it at your own pace, which is really important when it comes to things like climate change. And you really want to get into the science of it. That's not so easy, and it's not so linear. So we decided that that was the way to go, and it's that project's done great for us.
So a few more questions as time is running out. What's the best piece of advice you've received?
Best one?
One. Just one. We don't have a lot of time.
So. Okay. David Fanning would always say, do better.
What's the best piece of advice you have given?
Walk, don't skip.
What's the most
Unless you're a kid, then skip.
What's the most important characteristic of a leader?
Probably the belief that things can get better, I think. Believing that we're going somewhere in a more positive direction. Having the sort of inherent belief in what you do and backing it up with the work, the hard work. I do believe that I'm a really hard worker. That has a lot to do with my childhood, but I believe the hard work behind your words is when leaders inspire. I think leaders who talk a lot and don't do don't inspire. So if you lead with words and then you back it up with hard work, usually it works out pretty well.
Is there a leader that comes to mind for you?
Well, I love Paula Kerger. She's my favorite leader of the moment, and she runs PBS. So she is the person I look up to the most in leadership terms, and I think that's because I've seen her convene and contemporize an entire public media system up against the odds. And so I like that too. I like being up against the odds and overcoming it.
How do you imagine your children will receive the news when they're adults? Your children are, you mentioned,
10 and 13. I think very much like they are now, which is in snippets. I think what I have noticed with young people that is really inspiring is the desire for deeper and long-form analysis. So I think the work that Frontline does, so long-form documentaries, are a rage right now. I mean, I don't know if you're so aware, but I mean, obviously Netflix and Amazon and all these places that have, you know, serialized work now, people will watch, they'll binge watch. So I assume it's going to be a combination of short, very short informational pieces and then really deep dives into things that they're passionate about.
Does being a journalist or producer change at different times in life? So looking at what is newsworthy change because of who you are and the changes that happen in your life?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm a person who loves a big political story, so that'll never change. I think some of the stories we're telling now on Frontline may not have been told in the past, only in that I'm a mother and I'm a parent and I'm a person who cares about issues deeply. And I think the issues that are facing parents right now are so much more complex. So stories about digital media and also stories that are told from a perspective that is, how are we going to actually fix and really sort of contain some of the issues that we're facing are important. We're told a story this year by a woman who lived through the Syrian war, and she told it from the perspective of being a mother living in Syria and filming and trying to get out of Syria. We told that story, which we might not have told a few years ago, only in that I'm so taken with her story as a mother myself. But I'm pretty sure that fathers will be taken with it too, and people in general, because it's just a human story. So sometimes we tell these stories because we want you to wake up. We want you to feel something that you didn't know that you could feel before for someone that you think you really have nothing in common with. And all of a sudden you realize through being a parent or having those feelings that the commonality is more than you thought.
Why is journalism important in this society?
Well, I mean, I do believe in checks and balances. I do believe that journalists have an important role to play. I do believe that local journalism is where it's at. I'm super passionate about it. And I think that all communities should have vital and vibrant local journalism to make sure that what's happening at the local level is above board and is good for the community itself, the larger community. And without journalists, what do you know? How will you know something? There are local journalists here today, and the work that they do is so crucial to our democracy.
Will you talk a little bit about what you have just spearheaded and
yes.
maybe the Knight Commission and then what you just announced this last week regarding local journalism?
Oh, yeah. So I was on the Knight Commission last year, which was a commission that looked at media and our democracy and essentially through the lens of what's happening to our media. So we looked at cable. We looked at all the sort of forces at play on the commercialization of media, and we came up with a number of recommendations. What I focused on the most was what's happening to local journalism. And at the beginning of the year, this is now ongoing for years and years and years, of course, and it's not like a news flash, is that local journalism is being diminished. What that means at the national level is that when Frontline wants to work with local journalists in an area like this, there's only a few left. That should alarm everyone across the country. I do believe in this. So if there's one thing I could advocate for, it's for journalism at the local level. And so I did think that I'm not a local journalist. I have never been one. I've always been at the national level. That, again, like with this leadership idea of talking but putting action behind your words, is that we were granted 4 years of funding to actually start to fund local journalism in collaboration with Frontline. So national journalistic organizations usually come in and take local journalism without paying for it, right? There's no exchange of money there. We just take that journalism and give it a national airing, right? And in this case, we're going to be able to come in and actually pay for the local journalism that we'll work with them on and actually work together as a sort of national local team. So we're really excited about it. We're only going to be able to do it in 5 places to start, but I think 5 places is better than no places, and we'll see what happens after that.
Do you have a Frontline piece that's your favorite?
I never have a favorite.
Yes.
You ask these questions. That would get me in so much trouble. They're all my babies.
What Frontline piece would you recommend this whole group watch?
I might ask you to watch League of Denial if you haven't. That was one of the films I did as the deputy executive producer. If you haven't watched that, it would be a good one to watch about the NFL. I think the other great film to watch recently that might resonate is going to be coming up very soon, which is called Decade of Division. And that'll be a 4-hour series that we're going to do this coming year, looking at what's happened to America from the ground up to us and the silos that we now all live in, and how do we break through that. That's really where my passion is.
What do you believe is the most important topic facing the United States?
The most important, there are so many. See, I'm frontline. I'm long form. This is why that's... I would say divisiveness. I would say that the divisiveness that I feel... I do know growing up in a small town that was conservative-leaning that at the time there was a conversation that happened in that town between people who disagreed, who were the grown-ups, who were my role models. And so growing up in a town with people who had fierce disagreements and watching them have dialogue as opposed to either writing each other off or hating each other, I think is probably the biggest problem. And a lot of that is fueled by inequality, right? So I think at the sort of heart and soul of this is inequality and what are we going to do about the middle and working classes that need better jobs and better sustainability in their own lives and upward mobility. And I don't know what the answers to that are, but you'll be seeing Frontline do a lot more work on that area, which I know sounds incredibly hard to watch, but I think incredibly important.
Do you have a favorite book you read this year?
Well, I did read a book that I've been meaning to read called The Interpreter of the Maladies, which is by Jhumpa Lahiri. And she's an Indian author, so remember my Indian roots. It was really all about the feelings that this family was having and across generational and immigrant status and what was going on. And it was an interesting way to think about what we're looking at today.
Do you prefer visual art or audio, painting or opera?
Visual. I'm a documentary nut. Look at you with your note cards.
Frontline is nearly 40 years old, 37 years old. What do you hope people say about Frontline looking back?
One of the most interesting things about Frontline is, and why I decided to devote my career to it, is my hope is that it's not disposable. What I mean is I hope that the stories we're telling can be seen as our own stories that have sustaining, lasting value. So when we do and make a Frontline film, my hope is that you can watch it today, you can learn something, but in 5 years, you can also watch it and say, like, that's what was happening then, and it would still have meaning. So I hope we have a sustained quality to us, and I think we do. By the way, one of the things I'm most proud of is that Frontline has 200 of its films available online, so you can go on our website and watch them, and you don't have to pay for those films. And if you watch a film from 10 years ago, 12 years ago, you might say, like, the storytelling is a little bit slower, but you would say the stories are still valid and still resonate.
And you spoke a little bit about, too, and I think this is just remarkable, that the stories that you put together now, the films you put together now, you and your team go out of their way then to be fully transparent by putting up all your notes for those pieces.
So this is something that people ask me about all the time, which is how are we in the landscape of a sort of post-truth world with a lot of the sort of attacks on fake news and factual journalism? How do you counteract that? And one way we do that, I'm not saying it's the answer for all, is that we've decided to open up the reporting process at Frontline to be more transparent. And Frontline has a tradition, and this is David's tradition, of actually publishing its transcripts of the interview. So one way we get people to talk to us is that we say to them, we will not take you out of context. And we believe that so much that we're going to publish the whole transcript. So you can check us. If we took you out of context, it's right there for the public to see. We're not going to hide our edits. And I think that that has meant an increased trust with people talking to us. What we've done in this era is say, not only do we need to put the text transcripts out, we need to put the video, the longer form video interviews, and sometimes our interviews can be 2 or 3 hours. That's extended journalism, right? That doesn't make it into the actual documentary that you all see, that's digitally available and can be shared. So it's also searchable. So if you come on and you wanted to search this conversation and you wanted to look up truth, you can put it in the search engine and you can find the conversation that we just now had. So the idea is that we call it the Frontline Transparency Project. It's something I'm really, really dedicated to, which is our extended universe of our journalism. And how did we come up with our conclusions and who are we? The other thing we're doing is being much more transparent about who we are. Where do we come from? And that actually has been extremely helpful because you realize, oh, wow, We have too many people from the East Coast. We need to now hire people from the Midwest, the West, and the South. We need to actually diversify our own producing pool to tell stories that resonate across the country. The only way you start to make changes is by looking at yourself and asking yourself the tough questions that you need to ask.
Rainey, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for taking
thank
time
you.
And being here.
Yeah.
Being here.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
We have a piece of art from the Susie Kappa Art Center, an art studio for artists of all abilities. We hope it finds a place on your wall. And you remember this conversation and your first trip to South Dakota. So
wow.
I want to give you
nice.
This.
Thank you. Oh, it's beautiful.
Thank you
thank
for
you.
Being with us this morning.
Thank you so
Thanks.
Much. Thanks,
Our next guest is Dr. Nigel Locker, the director of the Fermilab. He'll join us on July 12th, and a special thanks to Mike Ray and South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and South Dakota School of Mines for helping set that up. But July 12th, Dr. Nigel, thanks.